Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Farmers markets. Do you get what you think you're paying for? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Farmers markets are growing like weeds in California, with 719 certified statewide and more than 300 in LA, Orange, and Ventura counties. Participating farmers are supposed to sell fresh produce they grow themselves, sometimes without chemicals. But not everybody obeys the rules. With state and local agriculture agencies short of resources, some markets try to police themselves. We'll look at how that's working out and ask, why are farmers markets so popular in the first place? Later on, does the world face another food crisis? First, here's the news. Wormen Only back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Drought, economic speculation, and climate change are threatening a worldwide food shortage, and the UN is worried about food riots like those of 2 years ago. Later on, we'll ask if a distribution system dominated by U.S. agribusiness needs to be overhauled. First, a very much related subject here in Southern California, the growing profusion of farmers markets. KCRW producer Christian Bordahl has been looking into why they are so popular and how customers can be sure they're getting the right kind of produce. Christian, what have you found out?
Well, I was at the farmers market in Santa Monica on Saturday, the one that's on Arizona, at the corner of 3rd Street, and I spoke there to a number of the farmers. I spoke to the manager of the market. His name is Mort Bernstein, and I spoke to a number of the people who were out there shopping. One of the things that that I think should be emphasized, I guess, at least to begin with, is just how much people really love their farmers markets. You know, the people that I talked to are were very enthusiastic. They felt like they got to know their farmers. They had a community of people there that they met with just about every week. They ran into friends. They brought their kids. One of the people that I ran into there happened to be a food writer. She was with another partner of hers that she writes with, and I picked them out of the crowd because they came along carrying huge amounts of vegetables. Her name was Brooke Burton.
I think the farmers market is really important to be connected to your food, but ultimately, I think there's something else going on. So when I came to the farmers market today, I'm having a hard time in my own life, and I walked into the farmers market today and I burst into tears. I just looked at the vegetables and I was like, vegetables. And, you know, when you are connected to the food that you take, it's such a base thing. It's so important. And when you know where your food comes from and who makes it, I feel more grounded. And so I don't go to church, but I go to the market, and I feel very protected and safe and warm when I'm around beautiful vegetables, which is really weird, but it's true.
So this is not only a social event for a lot of people, but it's sort of a spiritual event.
It is kind of a spiritual event, at least for some of them, I guess, yes.
Did you find a lot of people who talked like that?
At least a couple of them did mention the idea of spirituality. And the idea that obviously there are environmental issues, and a number of people brought those up, the fact that they do this because they want to act sustainably, because they want to have a sense of connection with the food and the people that produce the food. One of the people I spoke to, a farmer, Alex Weiser, I asked him, why he comes to the farmers markets, and I mentioned the idea of prices, because it seems that the farmers markets are more expensive, and if it wasn't a benefit for that reason, and this is what he had to say.
We can grow different things that people are looking for that are different. We grow things that have more value, that people who are out here looking for flavorful, delicious food, that you can't beat it. You know, a melon picked right off the vine, ripe, you know, not picked for shipping and sitting on a shelf for a long time. You know, you just can taste the difference in food that's grown local and delicious, and getting retail prices helps.
So obviously he's selling a product, but it does sound as if he has a kind of relationship to it that you might not find in the regular grocery store.
Yeah, I mean, he's first of all, he's selling retail, which means that he can cut out the middleman. So there's a real benefit to him there. And then he has an actual relationship with the people that buy his product. I mean, I've known Alex for a while now, and the people that work for him, because he does a number of the Santa Monica markets and elsewhere. You do begin to develop a relationship with the customer, I think, if you're the farmer, and that I think that has its benefits.
You talked about going to the Santa Monica market at Arizona and Third Street. Third Street. Greta Dunlap is manager of the Beverly Hills and South Pasadena Farmers Markets. And Greta Dunlap, it's good to have you on our program.
Well, thank you.
Tell us, if you will, what are some of the satisfactions from your standpoint, and what are some of the difficult things about being the manager of farmers markets?
You know, I find in surveys that I've done at the market why customers want to shop there. The top two things are freshness and variety. They can't get this at their local supermarket, so they like coming to the farmer's market because the produce is so fresh. It has such wonderful flavor. And they also like that relationship with the farmer. They build a bond with the farmer who's selling the produce. You know, I have customers that will travel to their farm. They spend the night with them. And it's a very, very special relationship.
They spend the night at the farm. Did they actually work on the farm?
A couple of them have gone up and worked on the farm, and they've just really enjoyed it and gotten to see, you know, a complete picture of what these farmers go through. It's not an easy job.
What's the difference between what you get at the farmer's market where you are and what you get at the grocery store? Let's say a good high-end grocery store.
It's the freshness, because this is usually picked the day before, and the variety of produce, fruits, vegetables that you find in a farmer's market, you cannot find in the grocery store.
What about the problem of making sure that what people are getting are, in fact, fresh, aren't, in fact, products that have been bought retail or wholesale, rather, and then brought in and sold as if they were fresh?
That's something, as a market manager, that we have to be very you know, we are concerned with, and it's something I do every day when I'm in the market. I check all the tables. You have to look for, there's signs that you can see, you know, if produce is too perfect. If you're seeing, you know, peppers in January and they don't have a hothouse. If you're seeing, you know, celery in July. So there's things that you need to keep an eye open for, to look, visible signs that you need to look for every market day on their table. And then I also do farm visits. I, you know, see what's on their table. I take pictures. I go out to their farm and make sure that they're growing what they're bringing to the market each week.
Again, Greta Dunlap is manager of Beverly Hills and South Pasadena Farmers Markets. Christian, you talked to a lot of people about this kind of thing.
Yeah, I did. And one of the things that I found was that the customers, I think, really, who shop there at the farmers markets, really want to trust the farmers and feel like they have a relationship. And the farmers themselves, I think, are concerned about this, because they recognize that if that trust is broken, that something important is lost in the exchange. And one of the people that I talked to was a farmer from Atascadero, just north of San Luis Obispo. His name is Greg Nauta. And this is what he had to say.
One of the markets I do, I walked about 3 weeks ago. I took a walk through it and just kind of looked up and down. And there was probably close to, if I had to guess, there's probably 80 to 100 farmers there. And I could count on one hand who I thought was actually legitimate. And it kind of blew me away, and it kind of made me mad too, because I know that I'm competing with people who have nothing in it. I mean, if they get caught, or if they get somebody sues them, or somebody, or the IRS goes after them, they have nothing to lose. They have no farm. They have nothing. I have everything into it. I've got land. I've got equipment. I've got everything. I've got more to lose than they do, and they're cheating.
Again, that's Greg Nauta, a farmer up near Atascadero. David Karp writes the Market Watch column for the Los Angeles Times. He is a pomologist. That's P-O-M-O-L-O-G-I-S-T. That's a fruit scientist. David Karp, we don't have very many pomologists on our program. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Good to talk to you.
What's your take on what Greg Nauta just said? If he says he could count only what did he say? On one hand, the number of 80 or 100 farmers who were legitimate, is that your experience as well as doing the Market Watch column?
There's a very wide variation in integrity at farmers markets. There are some, like the Santa Monica Farmers Market, where maybe 5 or 10% of the farmers are supplementing at one point in the course of the year, and the market managers are vigilant in searching them out. There are others where I think it is true. There are farmers markets that I've been to, I've driven 100 miles and said, oh my God, I can't write about this. They're almost all panoopsters. Panoop is the term I coined some 10 years ago for produce not of own production. So I turn around and go back. The majority of farmers markets are somewhere in between. My best estimate would be somewhere between 25 and 50% of the farmers who sell at Southern California certified farmers markets supplement at some time during the course of the year.
So supplement, then, has a special term in this context.
That means you may grow some, say, cherries or pears, but you're actually buying some or the majority, in many cases, of the product. In many cases, what these pirates, and that's what I call them, or privateers actually do, is they lease out certificates from the genuine farmers, and they're actually paying the people who are nominally their employer. You don't do that, do you? I don't, certainly. You get paid by your employer. Well, they pay the farmer in order to lease their certificate, in effect, and that certificate gives them a license to buy and sell illicitly, of course.
David Karp, again, writes the Market Watch column for the L.A. Times, a pomologist at UC Riverside. You talked to the manager of the Santa Monica market that you talked about earlier.
Yeah, his name is Mort Bernstein, and I asked him whether, you know, a place like Santa Monica that has more resources, it's a wealthy city, is able to more easily go out and actually check up on the farmers than some farmers markets in other areas, and this is what he said.
If they want to make the effort, it's not that hard. You run a market once a week, maybe two markets. You have time during the week, depending on how you're set up with the city or whoever you're working for. But some of these nonprofits who have 20, 30 markets, all they care about is getting the markets out there and making the money. They don't really care about bringing the fresh produce to the neighborhoods or care about what the farmers are selling.
John Edwards is board president at Raw Inspiration. That's a nonprofit organization that has 18 markets. It's the largest operator of farmers markets in Southern California, opening a new one in the Westwood Mall Shopping Center in Topanga coming up next week. John Edwards, good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much.
What do you say to what we just heard and what we've been hearing for the last couple of minutes here about the difficulty of policing these markets? What's your relationship with the farmers in yours? How do you make sure that the products are what they're supposed to be?
Well, I think there are several facets to this, because one of the things that we do, and what surprised me so far, as much as I agree with Mr. Karp and Ms. Dunlap and the manager at the farmers market, is that we police them, but we do also rely on the agricultural department. I mean, farmers actually pay a fee each market day that goes to an inspection program. And it seems to me that one of the problems is that we, the farmers market operators, are not working closely enough with the agricultural department. So that's something that we should all look for. And I think all farmers markets actually should share information, and we don't do that at the moment. But what we do as our company, we have we have 5 points. One is we have an 800 number, and any of our customers who suspect to any farmer, any vendor, they phone this 800 number, and we take seriously anybody complaining about any of our farmers. We also make farm visits. We also do another thing. Anybody who goes to any of our 18 markets can go to our website, put in the farmer's market location and the farmer's name, and we will email to that person certificates from the agriculture department to show what they're growing, the seasons, and all the information, photographs of their farm. So we think the answer is transparency, that to keep the integrity and keep the popularity of farmer's markets that's so important, I think the key is we just have to be totally open with our patrons. And I would agree, I didn't know it was so high what Mr. Karp says. I mean, clearly there's been cheating. And we have to do everything we can to stop that. But it seems to me one thing we haven't done, and that is the cooperation between all farmers market managers to share information and the Ag Department to share information. I think that's what we have to do.
Have you at Raw Inspiration ever been cited by one of the agricultural departments or another?
Well, we haven't. Our farmers have, and farmers can be cited for many reasons, whether their scales are not working properly or whatever. And, of course, I think every farmer's market's been cited. And unfortunately, it's a little bit more complicated. I agree again with Ms. Dunlop about, you know, people go there for the freshness of the fruit. Well, the fact is, though, that, you know, pears don't ripen on the tree, and so you won't get that the next day. And people sometimes don't understand that some fruit, actually, certainly the pear, is not something that will be sold the next day. And the other thing that we try to do, and I think most farmers' markets, because I think really all, most farmers' markets I know, Ms. Dunlop's at Santa Monica, everybody tries really, really hard to make farmers' markets a great place to go and have honest farmers. Of course, there are pirates, as Mr. Karp called them, and we're diligent in finding that. But the fact of the matter is sometimes it is difficult. You know, you rely on the county agricultural department certificates, you know, that they bring along to the farm and say, look, we grow this, and it's been approved of by the ag department, and they've got everything they say on their booth. And, of course, they could have supplemented. And it is difficult, but, you know, the managers have to be well-trained, and we pride ourselves on our managers that they're well-trained. Have we made mistakes and, you know, have we not spotted things in the past in 12 years? Of course, there's no question. But the thing is, we're always trying to better our systems, our process. And one of the best thing is transparency and working with all farmers markets and the Ag Department. That's what I feel, the only way that's going to get rid of this problem.
John Edwards of Raw Inspiration with 18 markets. Let me go back to Greta Dunlap, the manager of the Beverly Hills and South Pasadena farmers markets. What about the Ag Departments at the county and state levels? Do they have enough people to do the job?
They don't. And that's one thing we're looking at. Do we need to raise the fee? Currently, farmers pay 60 cents every time they participate in the market. That goes to the state for enforcement. And it was a recommendation I made last month when I spoke before the Secretary of Agriculture up in Sacramento that we need to look at raising this fee. I was talking to an ag inspector this morning up in Tulare County. I need some help looking at a farmer up there. And he was in at Lowe's Hardware measuring wood. And I go, what are you doing? Measuring wood. He goes, well, it's part of my job. We have to make sure that a 4x8 is really a 4x8. So they're spread thin.
Spread thin indeed. David Karp, back to you, the Market Watch column for the LA Times. You've been somewhat critical of Mr. Edwards and Raw Inspiration.
Well, I've looked at everything objectively. I was just reading an article of my own from June 20th, 2001, in which I described this scenario. This is entitled Market Makers from the food section of the LA Times, June 2001, in which I pointed out a vendor for Lim's Orchard who was actually selling stickered fruit from a orchard that, for which she didn't have authorization to sell. And I pointed it out to the founder of Raw Inspiration, or to the group that's now Raw Inspiration, Jennifer McComb. This was 9 years ago. This same vendor was on their board, was a founding member of the board of Raw Inspiration, and was on it until just recently when, as a result of one of the farms she was affiliated with being sanctioned by the San Bernardino County Agricultural Commissioner's Office, she was asked to resign and did so. It seems to me like that was the fox guarding the hen house, I must say.
Was the farm that was sanctioned one that was selling produce at Raw Inspiration markets?
That's right, and also at a lot of other farmers' markets, by the way.
Mr. Edwards, what about that?
Well, what about what? As Mr. Karp just said, this is a person that was selling at many farmers' markets, and as I told you earlier, you know, one isolated incident in 2001, and I do not know the details of that, is one isolated incident. But this is a farmer that's been a farmer for many years and has been at many farmers' markets, has great produce. And the fact of the matter is that was when we started farmers markets 12 years ago, was a founder of our farmers markets. And we have representatives of the farming community on our board. And that person was on our board. Now, rightly or wrongly, I mean, I didn't have a crystal ball in, you know, 1999, whatever it was. And so, but when we found there were some problems, we thought, look, the best thing to do is ask them to resign, and which they did gracefully. So if Mr. Karp is saying that we're the only ones who's ever had a vendor that's been cited, well, he's just wrong, of course. He said the problem is between 25 and 50%. So to single us out for one incident in 2001 is probably a little bit unfair. But still, one incident has to be looked into and action taken. And, you know, we took action. So I don't think that there's anything that I'm ashamed of or that we've done or not done.
Greta Dunlap, have you had farmers cited as well?
I've had farmers cited. I've removed farmers for not, you know, for bringing in product that they did not produce. Yes.
So how often does that happen?
Oh, I would say in the last 2 years, I have removed three farmers for not producing the product that they brought to market. One was removed from the program for 18 months. Another was fined $1,000. The third one I removed from my market, but they're still selling in other markets.
Christian, you talked to some other people.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I found interesting in talking to the farmers was the kinds of pressure that they are under. You know, one of them mentioned to me that the fact that they have to deal with a growing cycle, they have to deal with crop problems, all those sorts of things, means that they don't always have as much produce as they need at any given time, and that itself can create a pressure to cheat. Here's Greg Nauta again.
A manager has you in at their market, and they want you to bring your products. So you bring your products, and you're selling. If you can't supply enough, and they want the supply, they'll bring in another farmer, which is competition. That encourages a person to maybe supplement what they have to keep the competition out. The other thing is, if you have a bad year and you actually have a crop disaster, and we've had that before. We had birds destroy 10 acres of sweet corn, literally never harvested an ear off of it. Farmers markets are not grocery stores, and you have to live with Mother Nature.
David Karp, back to you with Market Watch. It would seem to me that it is up to the individual customer to some extent, make sure that he or she is getting what he or she is supposed to. What have you learned about the way to detect whether fruit is actually what it's, you know, the what's supposed to be sold at farmers markets, and when in fact it's been bought wholesale or someplace else?
Well, I learned that by talking to other vendors, although competitors must be taken with a grain of salt, by actually visiting the neighbors of farmers. And very often they'll say, what, are you kidding? I sold them that bin of apples or pomegranates or whatever it is. Occasionally the vendors themselves confess to me that they're actually getting their strawberries from another growing area. I don't know who they think they're talking to. Sometimes I see fruit that's clearly out of season for the growing area. Sometimes I see fruit that's all the same size or waxed, or I actually see the vendor unpacking a box from a commercial packing house. Sometimes I look at the certificates and I see that there's too much volume that they're selling, comparing what they have on the tree versus the markets that they're going to. Or it's the wrong variety that they don't have on their certificate, or that they don't even have that kind of fruit at all. Or I'll visit the farm and see that there's nothing growing there. That's not something, however, that the general public can do. You can't expect to learn all about the growing seasons and varieties in their and their seasons. You can't visit all these farms yourself. So the farmer's market customer has to depend on managers, the agricultural commissioners of the counties, and the state. The CDFA actually has a small enforcement program, and it has to be more effective. What customers can do now, however, is to patronize those farmer's markets, to vote with their dollars, to visit those farmer's markets like Santa Monica or Beverly Hills, or there's at least a dozen other highest-end farmers markets where the chances are better of buying produce from farmers who actually grow what they sell.
John Edwards, can you give advice to customers as to how they ought to make sure they're getting what they're supposed to?
Well, I can, actually, and I'm a little bit surprised at Mr. Karp. I think it is important that if you go to a farmer's market, usually because you're obviously interested in fresh, nutritional fruit. And I think, you know, his own boss has written a great book, How to Pick a Peach. And I would advise everybody to buy that book and read up on farming and local farming practices. I think they should talk to the vendor. They should ask where they're from. They should ask questions, how to store their fruit, how to prepare the fruit for recipes. I think the key is to build up a relationship with the vendor. We found over the years, it's the same people that go back to our markets time and again. They build up relationships, and they should ask questions. And to be honest, if they're not happy, they should walk off and go to the next farmer. If they feel they're not being told what they want to hear, there's other farmers. We have other vendors at our market. So the key is, again, what we want to try to do is to get our vendors to have maps at their booths where their farm is, you know, a red star on a map, their certificates. We feel transparency is the answer. We've got the people should know exactly the location of the farm, when they grow, what they grow, what the growing season is. So it's education, which I cannot believe they would be against if they're into this food movement. And we, as the farmer market management, should facilitate that. So again, it seems to me what we don't have and what we haven't had for years and what we need is the ag department, the farmers market managers, the farmers, and the customers, because it is, I wouldn't say it's a cult, but there is a real movement. And why can't this movement, why couldn't this movement communicate with each other?
That's all the time that we have. David Karp again with Market Watch with the LA Times. John Edwards, whom we just heard from with Raw Inspiration, has 18 markets around Southern California. Greta Dunlap, the manager at Beverly Hills and South Pasadena Farmers Markets, and all the other people we heard on our program today, as well as Christian Bordahl, our Which Way LA producer. Thanks to you all. Check out our Which Way LA Facebook page in a moment. Does the world face another food crisis on Which Way LA? Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. In 2008, a combination of natural events and economic conditions drove food prices so high that food riots erupted in many parts of the world. This year, there's concern the same thing may be happening again. But the ravages of 2008 aren't yet over. That's according to Raj Patel, formerly of the World Bank and the WTO, now fellow at Food First, and author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. Raj Patel, thank you very much for being on our program today.
It's good to be here, Warren.
What do you mean when you say that the ravages of 2008 aren't over yet?
Well, in 2008, food prices went through the roof, of course, but the recession hit globally. And what that meant was that for the poorest people on Earth, food became even more unaffordable than it was in 2008. So in 2008, there were 850 million people going hungry. And in 2009, the number of malnourished was over a billion. Now, in 2010, the estimates for the number of people who are malnourished has gone down a little, dropped to 925 million people, largely because of improvements in food availability and income in Asia. But in many ways, there's still tens of millions of more people from going hungry now than were in 2008. And for them, the emergency isn't over. It began in 2008, and it has continued to today. And so although prices have gone down for the middle classes around the world, for the very poorest people, things in many ways haven't improved.
Tell us, if you will, what combination of circumstances has come together recently to drive up the price of food?
Well, as I say, in terms of the international markets, we're seeing a mixture of things. In part, there's speculation in the price of food. In some commodities, there have been strange, or you know, not strange, but just unusual weather events. There have been droughts, for example, and irregular rains in India and in Brazil, which has contributed, for example, to a rise in the price of sugar. There have been failed harvests of tea, for example, in Kenya and again in India and Sri Lanka, and that's led to increases in the price of tea. So it's been a sort of mixture of weather and speculation. And then on top of that, in some commodities, what we've seen is a very sort of firm human hand in the increase in the price of food. So if you look at Russia, for example, Russia is one of the world's largest exporters of wheat. And because Russia had its biggest heat wave in 100 years, there were large fires. And of course, those fires spread out of control further because Russia's has cut back spending on its sort of fire control services. But that meant that there were fires in the grain baskets in Russia, and the Russian government announced an embargo on the export of wheat until 2011. And that drove up, that sent to the market a signal that wheat would become more scarce, and that drove up the price of wheat. And so what you have is both a sort of strange climatic event and also a poor policy and the consequence of being integrated so firmly into global markets in food meant that it was a sort of a conspiracy of lots of different circumstances that led to this increase in the price of food. But what happened then was that there were other countries that had to manage that supply shock. And so, for example, in Mozambique, the price of bread went up by 30% because the government subsidizes bread and it couldn't afford to anymore. Now, what that meant was that all of a sudden the price of bread was going up for the poorest Mozambicans. That meant that if you're spending more than 60% of your budget on food, all of a sudden a 30% price increase means that your food budget really doesn't go very far at all. And there were protests on the street of Mozambique, and these so-called food riots happened in Mozambique, as they've been happening throughout the world in 2010. Much less reported have been riots or protests in India and in Serbia and in Egypt. But these protests have been going on, and they're reflective not just of the volatility of prices in the international market, but also of government's failure to be able to deliver food to their citizens. And that's what a number of these food rebellions are about. It's not just about the volatility of prices, but it's also about government's failing to entitle their citizens sufficiently.
You've talked about the entire world, or much of it. Does hunger mean something different in different places, or is there one comprehensive definition of that term?
Well, malnutrition is the sort of overall definition, and that's about getting a sufficient number of calories per day, and that varies according to age and gender and a small number of other factors. In the United States, for example, the measure of entitlement to food is called food insecurity, and that is a more relaxed criterion insofar as one doesn't need to be eating less than 1,700 or 1,900 calories a day in order to be food insecure. In the United States, food insecurity is captured by the idea that at some point in the last year you were worried about being able to afford the next meal, or you didn't know where the next meal was coming from. So there are a couple of definitions, but these definitions are useful. The idea of food insecurity refers to a very real phenomenon of worrying about where your next meal is coming from. You don't need to have your ribs sort of poking through your skin to be worried about hunger, and for that to matter a great deal in the lives of you and your family. But again, malnourishment and being undernourished is a stricter criterion that does have a more international definition that the Food and Agriculture Organization applies to different countries.
Raj Patel, again, with the Food Institute. His latest book, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Nancy Roman is Director of Public Policy and Communications at the United Nations World Food Program. Ms. Roman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
How concerned is the United Nations? What are you watching to see how things are developing?
Yeah. Well, we absolutely are concerned because in many of the countries where we work, and the World Food Program is feeding 100 million hungry people in 74 different countries, food prices remain above long-term averages. So even though we've seen prices come off from 2008. In Bangladesh, for example, the cost of typical food basket is 54% higher than the five-year average. Or in Mozambique, corn costs 96% more than the long-term average. So we are concerned. But we're trying to be careful not to create a sense of hysteria. The Food and Agricultural Organization put out a report recently that did raise concerns because it said the prices of commodities had risen sharply. And it really warned the international community, look, pay attention to this. And this is after they had played a significant role in calming anxiety after the Russian fires that Raj referenced in August really spiked concerns. So we had 2008 peak concern. Then things began to level in 2009. Then in August with the Russian fires, there was a lot of renewed concern. You know, our sense is we're worried. We're paid to be worried. This is our job. And I agree with everything Raj said about how critical hunger is. I mean, if you don't get the food and nutrition you need, particularly, you know, from the womb to age two, it has lifelong consequences in mental capacity and health and so forth. So, yes, we care. You know, what are we watching? Well, we're watching a couple of things. There are some differences in 2008. You know, one of the things we watch is supply. So while, you know, food stocks for global commodities like wheat and so forth hit historic lows in 2008, the forecasts for 2010 are predicting it to be a large harvest. So even though wheat prices could be down, it's still predicted to be the third largest harvest in history. So we are watching closely the planting season because it will matter an enormous amount, you know, what is planted and how the next harvest goes. We're also watching oil prices. The high food price crisis in 2008 was driven partly because oil peaked around $150 a barrel. And that's significant because when you get above $90 or $100 a barrel, oil suddenly, biofuel becomes quite lucrative. And so you drive a lot of transferring, you know, food for food to food for fuel. So we're watching that, but current oil prices have been fluctuating between, you know, $70 and $90 a barrel. So that's something that we have our eye on. So we don't want to be too sanguine because, you know, look, between now and mid-century, the competition for food and water, I believe, is really going to be one of the driving issue. And it matters, and the world is waking up to it, and so, you know, we're taking some steps to address long-term supply, but, you know, it's critical. And I agree with Raj that part of the reason that people get exercised in these poor countries is not only because food prices spike, but then their governments don't seem to be capable of addressing the problem. And that's something we're really attempting to do at the World Food Program, is to try to help governments establish food security for their people, to position themselves to respond when this happens, so you don't have whole populations, you know, going without food at critical times and then, you know, leaving their children, you know, really damaged for life.
When you talk about planting, for example, is there any effort that's made to coordinate planting worldwide, or is that something that is just left totally to each individual country and the free market?
Yeah. Well, the World Food Program, that's not our area of expertise, but yes, the Food and Agricultural Organization, our sister agency at the United Nations, is looking towards, you know, the global crop supply and, you know, looking. Not only, you know, I think one of the things there's a lot of discussion about in the international community now is paying close attention to what we plant, you know, which crops do well, maximizing the output not only per hectare or per acre, but also from a nutritional capacity, and really starting to turn more attention to that area, you know, because you've got two issues. You know, you've got one, supply and demand. So I think the international community is rightly paying attention to that issue and others that affect global supply, because we're a population going from 6.8 billion to 9.1 billion mid-century. But another issue that we're paying close attention to is access, because it's not just about enough food. It's not just about planting enough. we could triple the amount of food tomorrow. If I could wave a magic wand and triple the amount of food that we had in the world tomorrow, we would still have hundreds of millions of hungry people, because a huge part of it is about access. And that's our role at the World Food Program, is helping to establish access to food and food security for families and individuals. And that's an issue of infrastructure. Sometimes in urban areas, people have, there's food in the markets, but people have no means to buy it. So we are working on developing cash and voucher programs that can help the poorest of the poor access nutrition. I guess I'd just say, to your question, yes, there are efforts at planting, but our efforts are really in access. And I think it's really critical to pay attention to that piece, because a lot of the world's poor are moving from rural areas to urban areas where there's really plenty of food, but people just, you know, don't have the means to access that food.
Again, Nancy Roman is with the United Nations World Food Program. Arash Patel, back to you. Is what we're seeing, do you think, becoming a trend? Is this something that's getting worse, that we're failing to get a handle on, or are we doing the best we can?
No, I mean, I think if you look at the ways in which policy has changed since 2008, you'll see that it's changed very little. I mean, what we've managed to do is make some commitments to feeding the hungry, and that's a commitment, sadly, that many governments are reneging on and providing insufficient funds for things like the World Food Program. But in terms of the fundamentals of the causes that led to the crisis in 2008, sadly, the fundamentals are still there. We still have a dependency on oil. We still have ways of growing food that are largely, hostage to markets, more open to speculation than they have been in the past. And governments have responded to the recession by, in many ways, withdrawing, reducing levels of entitlements. And that means that when the recovery gets underway, when the price of oil starts to recover, we will be in a situation where, in fact, we find ourselves facing many of the same policies, but without the basic entitlement. So, if we look to the United States, one of the things that got families through the early years of this, the rise in the price of food, was unemployment benefit. But now what we're seeing is the possibility that after 99 weeks, those who have exhausted their unemployment entitlements in the United States will not have access to that. And in front of the Senate right now is a proposal to cut food stamp aid even further. And that suggests that we're heading down the wrong way to ensure access and entitlement to food.
Arash Patel, again, with the Food Institute, his latest book, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. And let's turn now to the United States. Jonathan Bloom is a freelance journalist. He's a food waste expert. He blogs at Wasted Food, and he's author of American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It. Jonathan Bloom, good to have you on our program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
How do you come up with that figure?
The most recent figure puts waste at about 40%, but previous estimates have been higher, approaching 50%. The 40% number comes from an NIH-funded study, so it's fairly solid. And it's just a staggering amount when you think about how much we put into all the food we grow and what goes into growing that food. And then to turn around and not eat almost half of it, I'm still blown away by it.
Talk about the resources we put into it.
Sure. Well, a tremendous amount of fossil fuels through oil go into growing, harvesting, shipping, processing, even cooling our food. And increasingly, a fair amount of water is being used. There was a study that looked at all the water that goes into growing food, and it's almost as much as we put into almost as much oil is used, and increasingly, so much more water is used at the same time.
So enormous natural resources, water and fossil fuels, not to mention the land, of course. Is all of the food that is wasted edible?
Well, how I define the term waste, it is only the things that were at one point edible or could be edible. So there's a fair amount of food waste that ends up in the landfill that are things like peels and scraps. But yes, the 40% number are all things that were at one time edible. And the reasons we waste them are many. There's a tremendous amount of food that gets thrown out just based on superficialities, and we've become so specific in terms of what we look for in our food. We not only want it to taste delicious, but we also want it to look perfect. So anything that's the wrong shape, size, or color, or maybe has a little blemish in it, at some point along the food chain, it's cast aside.
Oh, where does that come from? Is that from the grocers? Do they set that standard, or do the consumers do it?
Well, there's a fair amount of blame to go around. I would put it equally in both sides. I think that the grocers think shoppers are fairly picky, and to a certain extent we are. And I understand that if you're faced with the decision of an apple that's perfect and an apple with a slight blemish, you're going to take the one that's perfect. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that something with a little blemish is trash. And so I'd like to see ways to keep it out of the landfill and to actually get it to people who will use it.
What does this all have to do with hunger in the United States or food insecurity?
Well, there's this strange coexistence of so much hunger and so much waste. And at the same time, there's a massive obesity problem. So the only conclusion I can draw from those three factors is that we have a flawed relationship with food, and there's a terrible problem with the distribution of the food that we do grow. We produce about twice the amount of calories that are needed, and then at the same time, waste about half of them. So perhaps that's not surprising. What is surprising is the lack of will to get that excess food to people who need it.
Jonathan Bloom, again, author of American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half Its Food and What We Can Do About It. Mark Winnie is author of Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners and Smart Cooking Mamas, Fighting Back in an Age of Industrial Agriculture. He was executive director for 25 years of the Hartford Food System. That's a nonprofit in Connecticut that works on hunger issues. Mark Winnie, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
You have in mind solutions, it seems to me, at least potential ones, to the kinds of problems Jonathan Bloom just outlined.
Well, I do think that there's a role for all of us. I tend to look at the situation at a more of an individual level or a community level as opposed to sort of the larger institutional levels, in as much as I think that the individual has a major role to play. And in reducing hunger and food insecurity, particularly in the United States, but also in perhaps setting the direction for or changing the direction of the way that our food system operates. Specifically, I think that we all, every single one of us, need to understand more about our food, where it comes from, how it's distributed, why the prices are what they are. In effect, we need to kind of get our heads above the plate. And I recommend three ways of doing this. One is that we actually start to pay more attention to producing food. I mean, this may sound trivial, but simply gardening is a way for us to really increase our own understanding and appreciation of food, as well as helping us with our own higher food prices, food quality, and so forth. I also recommend that we start to do more about how to cook food, learn more about how to cook food. A lot of our problems in this country around obesity in particular have arisen out of our inability to prepare food that's healthy from unprocessed ingredients, and that we've become more dependent on convenience foods, fast foods, and basically high fat, high salt, etc. And the third way is kind of the big picture, which is participation or democracy. It's not just being a good food consumer, being a good food citizen as well. I think that many of the problems alluded to by the previous speakers are ones where we have a lack of or scarcity of citizen participation, of actually becoming more engaged in how decisions get made in our food system. And in fact, we are conceding too many decisions at this point to large corporate food interests, as well as a small number of political leaders.
Mark Winnie, once again, formerly with the Hartford Food System for 25 years and now author of Food Rebels. And we'll read the whole title again until a bit later on. Raj Patel, let me go back to you, whom we heard from before, now with Food First, formerly with the World Bank and the WTO. It's often said that because of biotech, because of the kinds of industrial strategies that Mark Winnie is deploring, we are able to feed more people around the world. Is there a paradox here?
No, not really. I mean, the story is that because of green revolution seeds that were dependent on a great deal of irrigation and a great deal of fertilizer, usually oil, fossil fuel-based fertilizer, that yields have gone up. There are a couple of problems with equating that with biotechnology. First of all, increasing numbers of reports are coming in suggesting that, in fact, biotech has the same yield as conventional agriculture. So there's no big improvement, despite billions of dollars of investment in biotech, in terms of yield. One of the things that biotech does do is allow farmers to spend less time farming so that they can get a second job. But that's hardly, you know, that's an indication of the poor state of the farming economy rather than the benefits to all and sundry that might come from genetically modified crops. But what we're also seeing is, I mean, earlier on this year, there was a report on NPR where one of the chief scientists in Punjab in India, one of the men responsible for promoting the Green Revolution, was suggesting that the majority of Indian farmers needs to go organic because the fossil fuel costs and the cost of inputs are incredibly high. And irrigation has damaged soils in India to the extent that the kinds of farming that appear to have done well in the 20th century are just not suited to the 21st century. And I think Nancy is right from the World Food Program, and she was saying earlier on that the conflicts over resources that allow farming to happen, as well as the conflicts over how it is that we distribute food, are ones that are going to loom large in the 21st century. So I think one's appraisal of the Green Revolution and 20th century agricultural technology, and I think that there's enough evidence to suggest that a very mixed appraisal at best. In the 21st century, we don't have abundant water, we don't have a climate, we don't have mechanisms for distribution that allow a 20th century model to feed the world in the 21st century, and we do need a change. I'm very heartened that, particularly in the U.S. over the past decade, there's been an explosion in the interest in food, not only domestically but internationally, and the U.S. is moving to take a role in transforming the global food system, despite the sort of prevalence of large agribusinesses trying to turn it the other way. So I think what one needs to be clear-sighted about the challenges ahead, but also derive some measure of comfort by the amount of social change and the amount of the millions of people around the world who are trying to do something about this and who are moving in a very progressive direction.
Raj Patel at Food First, his latest book, The Value of Nothing: How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Nancy Roman at the United Nations World Food Program. Jonathan Bloom, author of American Wasteland: How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It. Mark Winnie, Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners, and Smart Cooking Mamas: Fighting Back in an Age of Industrial Agriculture. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. Look forward to talking to you all again. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point, Which Way LA, produced tonight by Christian Bordahl, Andrea Brody, and Gary Scott. Our technical director is Mike Newport. Email us, share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/whichwayla. Check us out on Facebook. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.